This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Police officials in Keene have taken to Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram to identify the major players in last weekend's riots. So far, more than 80 people have been arrested. Law enforcement has called on the public to help track down additional perpetrators. While the Keene Police Department's use of social media may seem novel, it is hardly alone. A recent social media survey from the International Association of Chiefs of Police reveals that 96% of police departments across the country use social media in some capacity. 80% of agencies report it has helped them solve crimes, and 73% say it's improved police-community relations. Here to talk more about how police departments are using social media to fight crime and bolster their image is Kurt Wagner. He's associate editor of social media for the site Recode. And Kurt, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So police in Keene are using social media to track down those who participated in last weekend's riots here. Has this tactic been successful elsewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that there's a lot of small examples of officers and police departments turning to social to be able to either identify suspects or to call out to the communities where crimes may have occurred and ask for more information. There was one instance in Oakland a few years ago. There was a shooting at a Korean Christian college in Oakland. And I spoke with the Oakland Police Department a few months ago about that. And what I learned was that this was the first time that the Oakland Police Department really felt like social media jumped out to them as being a useful tool. They were able to knock down some rumors that were being spread on Twitter. They were able to alert people to stay away from the school and hopefully prevent other people from being injured or affected by what was going on. And so I think that those are the instances that really jump out as being the most beneficial for social.
Are there particular social media platforms that are more effective for crime fighting than others?
I think if the police have a suspect or list of names of people that they're trying to identify, I think Facebook can be really beneficial. People share so much personal information on Facebook, where they live, where they go to school, where they work. So I think if there are names that the police are trying to vet, I think Facebook can be helpful. I also think that Twitter is really important because there is so much shared in terms of hashtags and location. You know, if there's a lot of people around a certain event, or if there's maybe a shooting at an airport or something where people can really use a hashtag to keep all conversation into one thread, I think that that's really a strong benefit of what Twitter can offer.
I also noticed that the hashtag Keene Pumpkin Fest, for example, or Keene State was used by several people who were actually the perpetrators. How sophisticated are these people? I mean, posting pictures of themselves tearing down a sign, maybe, with a hashtag for Pumpkin Fest.
I think people incriminate themselves quite a bit more than they'd ever like to admit. I mean, how many times have we heard stories of people who, you know, post photos on their Facebook that then come back to haunt them, or maybe share a status that ultimately leads police to know that they were in a certain area or even in this case, you know, committed a certain crime. So, social media actually, you know, people hurt themselves quite a bit by using it.
Well, so maybe the perps aren't so sophisticated, but how about within these individual police departments? I'm thinking that, you know, after the weekend riots in Keene, for example, people could just take down those videos. Are police departments employing people who are sophisticated enough to have captured those videos in some place, be able to find them? What's the level of expertise?
I think that police departments are still getting a feel for how best to utilize social media. I don't think that this is a setup where, you know, they really have firm rules and guidelines in place for the best way to use it. I think they're learning a lot. I'm sure that some departments are better than others, but for the most part, police officers from those I've spoken to really were shy about using social media even just a few years ago. They viewed it as a way to get themselves in trouble by accidentally either sharing information they weren't supposed to share or by, you know, posting things from their own public or private life. So I think that it's a work in progress. I don't think that, you know, if you posted a status and then removed it 12 hours later, I'm not sure that the police department would necessarily have the people in place to be monitoring that all the time. Mm. But I think they rely a lot on the public to help them with this. Because those of us who do use social media, we're on our phones all the time. We're on Facebook or Twitter all the time. So if we as good citizens can provide assistance, I think they rely on that quite a bit.
All right. You mentioned the possibility of police departments getting in hot water. We've heard of individual cops maybe getting into trouble. Police officer in Elgin, Illinois, fired last month for incendiary Facebook posts about the Ferguson, Missouri shooting victim, Michael Brown. So how are police departments handling personal accounts of officers?
First of all, a lot of these police departments put their officers through some kind of social media training, simply saying that you will be held responsible if you're posting on your personal account. And I don't think that's unique to police and fire departments, right? I mean, if you go to your personal account and you said something that was insensitive or racist or completely inappropriate, I would imagine that your own boss would probably call you in the next time you come into the office. So I don't think that it's really rare for officers to be held accountable for what they put on their personal profiles. I do think that they're, you know, as public officials essentially, or as public representatives, they might be held to a higher standard. So I think that these departments are really trying to warn their officers to be smart about what they post on social and understand that they're here to be representatives and good examples for the rest of us.
How about the role of the community in police department social media strategy? Oftentimes they're called upon to share information. Has the public been responsive for the most part?
From what I've heard, absolutely, almost too responsive. I think if you look at, for example, the Boston Marathon bombings that happened a few years ago, one of the big issues with social was that there was so much misinformation, spread over Twitter and Facebook. So there are so many people trying to help, so many people trying to ask what's going on and share photos and pictures that it can sometimes be overwhelming. I think that that's what officers have really experienced with when they ask for, you know, a call to action from the community. I think that one social network we haven't touched on yet, it's called Nextdoor. Mm-hmm. It's a social network specifically for neighborhoods. So when you sign up, you're not necessarily going to be friends with your old college buddies or even family across the country. You're going to be in the community with people in your geographic area. And what that does is it really narrows down who's participating in the conversation. So if I'm a police officer and there's been a series of break-ins in a neighborhood that I'm responsible for, I can go to Nextdoor, throw out questions. Hey, let me know if you see interesting suspects or if you've noticed a car sitting on the corner for a long time. And it keeps people from outside the neighborhood from chiming in, and it really kind of narrows down who can participate in that conversation.
So the goal of many of these police departments, yes, of course, catching criminals using social media, but also this idea of improving community relations, maybe adding some transparency, you know, maybe mm-hmm. providing behind the scenes photographs of what they do at the police department. Is it working, Kurt Wagner, do you think, in most of these markets?
I think it's an individual question, right? Because each person has different opinions of and relationships with police. For some people, the only time they ever see the cops is if they're being pulled over, or, you know, God forbid, they're knocking on their door about some kind of crime that's happened in their neighborhood. So it's not always that the police are viewed in this really positive light, right? They're oftentimes associated with negative things happening. So as you mentioned, a lot of them are trying to turn to these social platforms and, you know, share behind the scene photos. Hey, here's our police academy. Here's some of us training. Here we are at the summer potluck at the community park. And just trying to kind of put a face and a personality to what the police do. If you're talking to me, when I look through these types of videos and I see the kinds of, you know, personalities that they're trying to convey, I think that it helps. You know, it personifies the officer. It's no longer just someone in a car with the lights on. But I think that that's an individual thing. I think a lot of people have different experiences with the cops over their lifetime, and so it'll impact people differently.
Kurt Wagner, thank you so much for giving us a glimpse to how police departments across the U.S. are using social media. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Kurt Wagner is associate editor of social media for the site Recode. You'll find a link to more of his work on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And up next, we're going to move offline for a look at a well-orchestrated scam that directly targets seniors using actors, census information, and landlines. That story when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few weeks ago, I got a distress call from my 91-year-old father. He said that my nephew, Andrew, had called him in a panic and told a story that he'd been in New York City for the weekend with a friend and that they were in the car of two guys they met and had been stopped by the police. The cops found cocaine and a loaded gun in the car, and now Andrew was in jail and needed $2,500 for a lawyer wired to him pronto. My dad said that Andy begged him not to tell anyone and hoped that he could count on him. Well, it didn't make sense to me. Andrew's a pretty responsible guy with a great job at a big Boston architectural firm, and his wife is a lawyer. Why wouldn't he call her? I'd heard of similar I need help immediately scams sent through email, but a call? Are you sure it was Andy? I asked my dad, or rather yelled. His hearing aid never does very well on the phone. Well, it sounded like him. Did he call you Gramps? Well, yes, I think so, said my dad. He's 91, but in excellent health and sharp as a tack. Not someone you'd think of as scammable. Yet he and millions like him have been targeted by creative and aggressive swindlers who set up in boiler room-like call centers, mostly in Canada. A simple text to my nephew thwarted this ripoff, but as many as 75% of these crimes work and go unreported. Shirley Straczynski wrote about all the players in these elaborate cons for Pacific Standard Magazine. Shirley, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, Shirley, one of your friends was nearly taken in by a similar multiplayer con. What happened?
Well, actually, two of my friends were. The first one is a woman who is an emeritus professor, absolutely has all her critical thinking processes intact. And I happened to talk to her when this was going on, and she was she was speaking with great urgency, and she said, I said, are you sure? And she says, yes. She says, it was my nephew. I know his voice. It turned out that she then went and sent several thousands of dollars off, and it turned out that her nephew had been out hiking and was out of range. She hadn't been able to reach him. And she had been scammed, and she was humiliated. Mm. And I said, well, we should tell our friends about this. And she said, oh, no, I don't want a word spoken about it. It's so embarrassing. I didn't say anything more. But then a few weeks later, my longtime next-door neighbor, he also got a phone call and was told it was his grandson. And he told much the same story that my other friend had his grandson called and said, Grandpa, I'm in trouble. So Dick, I don't think he knew at first an idea that this may not be right. Mm-hmm. Oh, he did say to him, but you don't sound like Eric. Mm-hmm. The so-called Eric said, well, that's because in the accident, the airbag went off and injured my mouth. And So I'm having a hard time speaking. There was an answer for everything.
Right. A lot of this sort of improvisation here with this sense of urgency. And then other players got on the line. Someone pretending to be something else. Someone pretending to be a cop reporting the accident. Someone pretending to be a lawyer saying, oh, your money didn't get through. How much money did Dick send off?
He sent off $1,950. Mm-hmm. And then in both cases, it was supposed to have been settled, and there was another story. In Dick's case, it was in the courthouse, there was a bomb scare, and they had to start all over, and he had to send another wire transfer. Well, he has red lights flashing there, but he said, I'll get back to you. He called his grandson's cell phone, and this time the grandson picked up. And then he sat down and did something unique. He sent an email to everybody he knew, including me, explaining what had happened to warn people. And that is what is not happening. Because of that, because people don't report it, we really don't have any idea how big this is.
Yeah, in fact, you spoke to somebody from the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center said there's compelling evidence that more than 75% of victims fail to come forward. And Canada plays into this. Like in my father's case, one giveaway was the area code that they were that these calls right. were calling from, which is 514 Montreal, Canada, the queen city of the grandparent scam, as you call it. How did this come to be in Montreal?
I think probably they just figured out how to do it there. I don't know quite why it is so concentrated, but it is very much concentrated in Montreal. The Canadians and the Americans have gotten together, and they have something called COLT, which is a center of operations linked to telemarketing fraud, in which the U.S. and, you know, the Royal Mounted Police and the U.S. Postal Inspection and the Department of Justice here work together. But frankly, it's very hard to catch these guys.
He even described it as whack-a-mole. You get one and another one pops up.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, you got an idea of how these cons work from officials at COLT, a reporter who went undercover, and from a former scammer. Now, they set up these kind of boiler room-like situations where they make these calls. What are they like, and where do they get the leads?
Well, I did interview one man who was in the middle of this whole operation in Montreal. He said they move around constantly every, I don't know, several months. They change phones. They buy these throwaway phones. Mm-hmm. They have one for their outgoing calls, one for the incoming calls, and one for their business calls. These phones are tossed out after, he said, something like $10,000 or so many weeks. Mm-hmm. So there's really no way to trace these calls. And it's really, these are actors, and they're very compelling.
Talented actors, urgency, familial love, and a measure of humiliation are the ingredients of a scam that has bilked grandparents for millions of dollars. Shirley Strashinsky is with us to talk about the so-called grandparent scam, an international crime ring, and law enforcement's attempts to thwart it. Shirley, where do they get the leads? How do they find out who to call?
Well, there are, you can buy lead sheets. Perfectly legitimate companies with, you know, phone numbers, names and phone numbers. The census is another way, another good way to find the names of people, where they live, and their family members. There's a phone book. The reason I think, one of the reasons the elderly seem to fall victim is because they have landlines and they're likely to be at home. Mm-hmm. But as far as the money, we tried very hard. The magazines fact-checkers, and I spent some time trying to pin down how much money. And there's this figure of $40 billion that floats around out there, but I couldn't find out where it came from. But in fact, most people don't report how much they've lost, and they think maybe it's only 1% to 5% report it, which means it really is, the take is huge.
That's a tragedy to me. I mean, in the case of my dad, I would say he hears in the media about horrible things that kids do or the kind of trouble they can get into. He also knows from watching enough thrillers that if he's told that he can't tell anybody about what's going on, there could be dire consequences. Playing on emotions, playing on a lack of awareness maybe about the lives of one's grandchildren or nieces and nephews. So I'm wondering if Ivan, this young man you talked to in federal prison who was one of these scammers, any awareness on his part, any bad feeling about playing on the emotions of, you know, very vulnerable people?
Yes, he said so. And he described the kinds of people that he worked with. Although one study I read said these are white-collar young men, mostly men. He said, no, they aren't. He says they're working-class lower. And he said that most of them are, you know, have had trouble. They're in debt. Some have drug problems. And they find this an easy way to make money. But I think that that's probably, you know, they've learned this one thing, and they're making a lot of money.
How much? And how much can they be making?
Well, Yvonne, he estimated that the reps each take in $2,000 to $5,000 during an average week, $10,000 in a good week, and in a rare, great week, as much as $20,000.
Mm-hmm. How about larger consumer protections? I'm thinking of the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, which was started a couple of years ago to help people from just these kinds of frauds.
They think the best way to stop this is to get the word out. As soon as people know about this, then it won't happen to them. And in fact, I think there so much has been done in the United States. It's not hard to find people who know someone who has this has happened to. But I think the agencies who are supposed to be doing this for us are really kind of not spending a lot of time on this.
Shirley Straczynski, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Shirley Straczynski wrote about all the players in these elaborate cons for an article called The Grandparent Scam that was in Pacific Standard Magazine. You'll find a link to read her article at wordofmouthradio.org. While Ebola may be dominating the headlines today, back in 2009, it was all about a nationwide outbreak of salmonella. Word of Mouth continues with a look back at the epidemic and the role the CDC's disease detectives played in containing it. First, the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
Well done.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. They call them disease detectives. They're the medical eyes and ears on the lookout for outbreaks of disease, bioterror attacks, and changing trends in chronic disease. They're the Epidemic Intelligence Service of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Assignments take them all over the world to handle outbreaks of measles, malaria, even Ebola. Each July, some 70 new trainees join the Epidemic Intelligence Service to become EIS officers. Part of their training involves reviewing and investigating old outbreak cases. This is the tale of how two rookies learned to become disease detectives by solving the case of the Nutty Dish.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you are about to hear is a dramatization of an actual outbreak investigation solved by the men and women of the Epidemic Intelligence Service. It's now a case study used each year to train new EIS officers. You are Epidemic Intelligence Service officers at the Centers for Disease Control. You are assigned to the Foodborne Outbreak Investigations Unit. In the past month, the CDC laboratory identified a new strain of Salmonella typhimurium. It's made people ill in 15 states. Your job? Find out the source of this new strain and stop it from spreading.
Hi, my name is Katie Curran, and I am an incoming EIS officer at CDC.
Epidemiology runs in Curran's family. Her dad was an epidemiologist at CDC and an EIS officer. She's 33, has a PhD in epidemiology, and can't wait to join EIS.
It's every epidemiologist's dream, I think, to do EIS training because it's really cool applied field investigations and applied epi.
Matthew Westerkamp, I'm one of the incoming EIS officers. Originally, I'm from Nebraska, and I practiced mostly in Chicago, where I worked primarily in nursing.
Westerkamp's lanky and relaxed. Once, he worked as a shepherd. That's right, herding sheep. Now, he has a PhD in epidemiology. At 37, one of the oldest trainees. Wife is also an EIS trainee. For 6 years, he was an AIDS researcher in Kenya. Until now, these two rookie disease detectives had never even been on a single case of salmonella, let alone an outbreak that was spreading nationwide. Now, pressure was mounting.
Something like this is urgent. A lot of new cases coming in. People are being hospitalized. People are dying. We need to make decisions quickly, but we need to think long-term what the ramifications if we make a wrong decision.
The new strain had a clean rap sheet. No prior outbreaks. The only clues were the age, gender, place of residence, and date of illness for the sick patients. Westerkamp pulled out his laptop and did the numbers.
Yeah, we have a lot more older females than males. I wonder if it's mothers. We ran descriptive statistics, so looking at if there were more men than there were women or how old the cases were. We initially noted that the cases were younger than we would expect generally. We also saw that they were very spread out across the country.
Salmonella is a common cause of food poisoning. It's the kind of bacteria that'll kick you in the stomach, give you a fever, diarrhea, and cramps, and leave you flat on your back or in your grave. This new strain was serious, and it was spreading.
I started thinking, why is it children? Young people are usually healthy, so why are they the ones who are being reported as cases?
I initially thought that it was something to do with like a fast food establishment, just by the way it looked. We saw this young cohort of patients without the accompanying adult. There was some thought that it might be a specific food item at a fast food restaurant causing illness differentially in the kids.
What could all these people have eaten that made them so ill?
You know, more than half of people had consumed eggs at home, had consumed butter, had consumed regular milk, chicken nuggets, and peanut butter.
But those are the usual suspects when Salmonella is on the scene. The EIS officers needed more. They dug deeper into the evidence, asked more questions, and came up with answers. Their answers didn't always agree.
I think chicken looks pretty promising. I'm personally holding out for peanut butter. I just think you have to have a favorite horse going in. Scientifically, looking at the numbers, it definitely looks like the chicken at this stage is probably, there's something going on there.
Some people in our team really are convinced it's the chicken nuggets. I think it could be the peanut butter too. I don't know. We really don't know.
Chicken or peanut butter? It wasn't straightforward. When outbreaks like this happen, the CDC calls in the troops. Operatives from far and wide are drafted. They call hundreds of ill patients and well people too. Their objective? Learn exactly what these people ate. The trainees sifted through the data in the case of the nutty dish, and they came up with a likely suspect.
Of all the foods that we asked about, which were about, I think, 50 different food items, peanut butter was significantly more commonly reported in the ill individuals than the well individuals.
But to close this case, they needed more proof. Then they got a lucky break. In Minnesota, some of the ill patients weren't young people. They were in nursing homes. Investigators there found identical tubs of peanut butter, all the same institutional brand. In one of them was the Salmonella. 1,300 miles away, Connecticut investigators found the same thing. Salmonella in an unopened tub of the same brand of peanut butter. It was the peanut butter. When a food product is involved, the FDA gets on the case. They're the guardians of the U.S. food supply.
The FDA has and local state health departments and the local Department of Agriculture or Food has visited a peanut product factory in Georgia. And they have found that there has been a salmonella contamination there. And so the FDA has recalled peanut butter that has been made in this factory and distributed to institutions.
Trainee Westerkamp thought it was all over.
A food item has been identified, and it's been confirmed that that's the cause of this particular outbreak. We have a smoking gun.
But it wasn't. Even after the peanut butter was recalled, cases kept being reported. Now over 530 states. Some of the clues didn't make sense. Not all the sick patients remembered eating peanut butter, and most of the cases weren't in nursing homes. Peanut butter had to have an accomplice. It didn't take the FDA long to find one. It was hiding out in the peanut plant, an inside job. The same plant that made peanut butter also made peanut paste, a sticky peanut product made from ground nuts. That's right, it was tainted with salmonella too. Peanut paste is in a lot of foods.
There's peanut cookies, peanut butter cookie dough, peanut sauces that are in stir fry, peanut butter paste that's in peanut butter crackers, some ice creams, and candy, some candies that have peanuts in them.
That explained a lot of things. The Yale patients who said they didn't eat peanut butter weren't giving false testimony. Turns out, they ate peanut paste, and they probably didn't even know it. In the end, almost 4,000 products containing peanut paste were recalled. Case closed. Six months after it began, the outbreak died out. But not before 700 people became ill. 9 died. EIS trainees Westerkamp and Curran passed muster. They graduated, and they're now at their CDC posts. It won't be long before they're called on to investigate a real-life outbreak. When the call does come, Curran's ready.
I'd say, bring it on. Let's go. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
But one mystery remains. Will Curran be packing a peanut butter and jelly sandwich?
And here's an update on this story. Ramifications of the outbreak rippled through the food processing industry and led to the passage of the Food Safety Modernization Act. There were legal implications, too. In August of 2014, executives of the peanut processing plant went on trial on criminal charges for their role in selling tainted food. All three were found guilty of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and wire fraud. They could each face more than 20 years in prison. Dr. Philip Graetzer, a former EIS officer, produced this story. The voice of the narrator was Adam Fristow. And this program is part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Up next, we're going to swing to the far less rational, fact-based end of the scary scale to discover how music can make a creepy film even creepier. How one musician sets the mood for Nosferatu, the silent vampire film that has remained terrifying for almost 100 years. We'll raise the beast when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Long before Frank Langella, Anne Rice, the Twilight movies, and True Blood, vampires were not such gorgeous beings. Back in 1922, the German expressionist filmmaker F.W. Murnau concocted a ghastly monster with pointed ears, bushy eyebrows, long claws, and rodent-like fangs in the film Nosferatu. Nosferatu is the first surviving vampire movie to be made. As of this year, it remains Rotten Tomatoes' best horror movie of all time and is one of several scary silent films playing in the area this Halloween season with musical accompaniment by Jeff Rapsis. Jeff is co-owner of the Hippo Weekly newspaper and author of the Silent Film Music Blog and is playing for us now. Jeff, great to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for playing. What can you tell us about this film, Nosferatu, from 1922, adapted, apparently unbidden, from Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Yes, there were legal challenges, even in the silent film era, copyright disputes and other things. In fact, this was a pioneering film in that respect because it was one of the first films in which the people from the estate of Bram Stoker, the author, were able to successfully get a judgment against the filmmakers who had basically ripped them off, changed all the names. That's why it's not Dracula, it's Nosferatu. They just changed all the names and thought that would be enough to be able to use the material. It wasn't done out of malice. They just didn't want to get permission, I guess. And as part of the judgment against them, all the prints of the film that had been made were supposed to be recalled and destroyed.
Well, now, after all these movies that we see now with special effects, you know, spurting arteries and that kind of thing, it's still really creepy.
I think it's even more creepy now than it might have been in some ways, because silent film, which used to be, you know, it wasn't silent film when it was new. It was the movies. Nobody thought they were missing anything. But now, now that we have film and cinema that has everything, to go back to an era where we've got a very limited toolkit to tell the story, just the visuals and music to go along with it, it creates a whole nother level of emotions that we're not used to. So it seems otherworldly and creepy in a way that makes all the great silent horror films really great for Halloween nowadays. If people want to dip their toe into the silent film ocean, Halloween is the time when that happens a lot.
Well, apparently only part of the original score for this film actually remains. But you don't use a score. You improvise all of these?
One of the things about silent film is that the music was different in every place that it was shown. And it was actually the exception rather than the rule for any music to be created for a film, whether it was from Hollywood or in Germany, which is where Nosferatu was made. And it was very much a local enterprise. Theaters would hire their own musicians. And oftentimes you get the cliche of grandma playing a single piano to keep up with the film, but it wasn't like that at all. Even in the smaller film theaters, you have a group of musicians who would work together, and they might know 50 or 60 cues of all different types. So you could have music for a love scene, and I can pull that up here. You'd have like a... So they might know something like that, but then, you know, here comes the guy on the horse. And they would launch into that, and they had their own vocabulary of music to go with whatever happened to come into the theater. This happened all around the country, all around the world. Later, theater organs were developed so that instead of having to employ a huge orchestra, A theater owner could just have one person playing a massive theater organ and really have the same effect. That became the real soundtrack of
silent
films. Yeah,
we associate it with organs, especially scary movies.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, that has always been one of the things that people expect from it. And with Nosferatu, you know, you don't want to disappoint them, and so I do a lot of organ stuff with it, but not just organ stuff. With that film, with Nosferatu, you can do a lot of things that may not have been going on back in the silent film era, but since... scoring of films has come a long way, and so I draw from some of the vocabulary that's developed since then. So there's Bernard Herrmann in Psycho, for instance. So a string texture like that can really be effective, even though that might not have been used back in 1922 when this film was first released. And I improvise in real time, and it always comes out different with me. It depends on the audience, it depends on the theater, it depends on what I had for dinner that night, and, you know, whether the dog got loose today. but it always makes for a different performance no matter what, which is part of the reason these films, not just the horror films, but all the films, I think, still have a lot of life in them, because they can be different and adapted to a modern sensibility to reach across the decades and now almost a century since these films were brand new in theaters.
How do you choose the films, or do you actually choose the films that you play for?
I do a lot of screenings all around New England, and in some places I get requests for certain popular titles, such as The Phantom of the Opera. What I really like to do, though, is to work with venues to find films that don't have a large audience, that are not... part of the acknowledged list of classics like Birth of a Nation, mm-hmm. or some of the Buster Keaton features and things that people, you know even today as great films, and instead find films that are just as powerful with an audience, if you can put them in front of an audience on a big screen with live music, but have just somehow fallen by the wayside. And there are dozens and dozens of them that really do spring to life if you can recreate the conditions that silent film is supposed to be shown under. And you can see these films now on YouTube or on your cell phone or on home video, but you're missing part of the experience if you don't go to the trouble of trying to stage them the way their creators intended for them to be shown, which is on a big screen with live music and in a theater with an audience.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of your conception of Nosferatu.
The thing about the vampire movie is that he has powers that go beyond normal human beings, and we don't really know what they are at first, and this is a time when people didn't know the whole vampire cliche that, like we do. And so I have a chord structure that I sort of underlie all the improv with, which starts with a minor chord like this. And then it evolves to sort of a grand major chord with a bass line that goes up. Hear that? And so you can use that underneath a lot of things. And you can shift it around into different parts of the keyboard and put different harmonies under it. And if you stick with that, it makes everything fit together in a way that sounds like you had to have planned that out, but I don't. It's just that I'm using just a few building blocks. There it is down below there. And you can add some repeated notes into it. You can wind things up with kind of a grand cadence. But something else is happening. That's way down below there. You can get to a place where things are really strange. Very open harmony. There's no harmony really there except the fifth of the chord. And then we can sneak in our little signature melody. And it gets even more creepier depending on, you know, what other notes you fill in and where you go in the bass. Let's keep it climbing, going up. And now let's make it in the bass where we get back to the melody again. And we're ready for whatever happens next.
Strikes me that you're responding very much to what's going on now, the live audience, the experience of the film being screened. But you, Jeff, are also communing with the dead on some level. I mean, you have a dialogue in some way with Buster Keaton and Mary Pickford and Lon Chaney.
Yes, it's true that I collaborate with dead people. I've tried collaborating with the other kind, and it doesn't always work as well. I try to respect what they were trying to achieve. It's not about the music. This is not a forum for me to play wonderful music and have everybody go, oh, isn't that nice? What I try to do is to get to the essence of what the people creating the film were trying to do, what kind of emotions they were trying to evoke in people, and what kind of narrative arc they were constructing, and try and come up with music that supports all of that. One of the best compliments I can get, and I'm glad to say I hear it quite often, is that I forgot you were sitting there playing music live. Mm. Because what I want to do is create an environment where people are so wrapped up in the film that they forget that the music is being created right there.
So you're a rare performer in that you wish to be become invisible.
Oh, I have a huge ego. That's why I'm here on the radio with you. But the essence of this is to disappear, yes. It's when the lights go down, the movie is what should be first and foremost. For people who knew silent film and grew up watching it when it was new, when it was over and people moved on, nothing was more old-fashioned. It'd be like us, you know, we laugh when they blow up the disco records at the baseball park because who would ever want to hear disco again, right? And silent film was like the disco of the 1930s and 40s. No one would have ever taken it seriously. Many of the prints were just thrown out or melted for their chemicals. And it was only later when people came along who had not experienced it firsthand said, wait a minute, there's something of value here. And then the rush was on to try and recover what we could find. Turns out only about 20% of the films that were made during this part of cinema's history survived.
There's a big surge in popularity in the silent films being shown with live music. What do you think is behind that?
Well, I suppose there's many things. In my experience, I found that people are drawn to it because it's a collaborative and a collective experience. This is an age where increasingly we consume content on our own through the internet and through social media. Even though social media brings us together in other ways, a large part of that interaction is spent on our own in front of a screen. And events like a silent film screening requires you to get out and be somewhere, and you're part of an event and a happening that, because of the way the music is done, is going to be a unique and special thing, and the audience is never going to be the same again either. And so we all collaborate in bringing what is just a can of celluloid on its own to life as a great achievement of cinema from the early couple of decades of the movies.
Well, Jeff Rapsis, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeff accompanies Nosferatu at Red River Theaters in Concord on Friday, Phantom of the Opera at Levitt Theater in Agunquit, Maine on Saturday, and also at the Flying Monkey next Thursday. Also, there's a Lon Chaney Halloween Creep Fest featuring the Unholy Three from 1925 and West of Zanzibar at Wilton Town Hall Theater on Sunday, and The Cat and the Canary next Wednesday at Rogers Center for the Arts. That's at Merrimack College in Andover, Massachusetts. A busy, busy man. There's much more on the films and the schedule at the Silent Film Music Blog. You'll find a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today, and we do invite you to share segments with your friends and to download the Word of Mouth podcast that's on iTunes. You can also get it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Who doesn't remember how well creepy stories travel by word of mouth? I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come back for a compilation of some of our most popular stories. That's going to be this Sunday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. That was really fun.